welcome to a special edition of Crossbody of Work. My name is Evan.
I am Javier.
And it's a special edition because it's not just the two of us. Instead, we are joined by the author of the six-pack on the open road in search of WrestleMania, Brad Baloukjian. Hey, Brad.
Hey, Evan, Javier, how are you?
We are thrilled you're here. We got to read the book. We got to read the six-pack, and now we get to talk to you about it. We are so happy you're here. This is a first for us to interview an author. It feels very smart. We feel very important. But we're thrilled because a book that is truly for wrestling fans, that is an ode to an era of wrestling. We talk about old wrestling all the time. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of the book and kind of the origins of your wrestling fandom?
Yeah, I've been thinking about how this book now is covering stuff that's more than 40 years old in some cases, and in a sense that would seem like, you know, bode pretty poorly for, you know, having any kind of relevance today. But I think that the reason why it does resonate with a lot of people is even if you weren't around back in the early to mid 80s. You probably have heard that, you know, the whole Hulkamania phenomenon that started beating the Iron Sheik in 1984, you can kind of draw a line from that to where we are today in wrestling. Mm-hmm. And even if, again, you aren't that familiar with the 80s WWF explosion, it really kicks off what I would call the modern era of wrestling being more about entertainment than trying to portray itself as sport. A lot of people may not realize that, like, when I was growing up in the 80s watching, I mean, I knew my dad right from the jump, he's like, this is not real sport. And I think I intellectually knew that, but I still would get sucked into it and you sort of suspend your disbelief. And the presentation was different back then. It was a little more grounded in on the mat and in reality. You didn't have quite the same degree of backflips and moonsaults and everything. and of course the promoters, they said this was an actual competition. This was real sport. I mean, it wasn't until the late 80s that the promoters started to openly admit that it was entertainment. It was a show. And then things changed quickly from there. But yeah, I grew up loving the Iron Sheik. He was my favorite wrestler. He was my hero. I got to know him personally when I was in college through just a lot of my dogged pursuit of trying to find him and get to know him. Went through all these. I got into it a little bit in the book, in the prologue, about how I tracked him down through his agent, and I got to meet him at a autograph signing in Secaucus, New Jersey. And next thing you know, he's just smoking buckets of marijuana in front of me and, you know, high out of his mind, 4 a.m. asking me to drive us in my shitty 93 Ford Escort to a 24-hour diner. It was quite an introduction to the Iron Sheik, but that was the beginning of a very interesting relationship, because a few years later I tried to write a book with him and left my job at a magazine.
Yeah.
And that's when the death threats happened and things went sideways. And fast forward to a couple of years ago when I had done a successful book about tracking down baseball players, and I said, well, why don't I revisit that theme but with wrestling and try to go find the Iron Sheik again many years later, and also other wrestlers that were there when he won the championship. And that's the six pack, or the people like Sergeant Slaughter and Tito Santana, other wrestlers that were on the card. And really the book's about, you know, the extent to which they became their characters and kind of who they are in real life.
And it's a really interesting, like, entry point to the book. I also realized you and I have the same first car, a 93 Ford Escort.
Maybe it was the actual same car.
That wouldn't surprise me either, with the roll down windows. When you talk about rolling a window and you do this, nobody tape under deck, the age of 30 knows what you're doing.
Tape deck, no auto locks, roll windows. Yeah.
And it was fine.
That was fine.
It moved. That's all you needed.
It actually was, you know, probably better than some other cars I've had since that are fancier. So.
And
my
so you
first car,
like,
was a 2013 Honda Civic.
Oh, my goodness.
I got it like 5 years ago. So.
Yeah. My first car was in 2013. It's 20 years older or newer. Good for you.
All right. Well, it wasn't in 2013. I would have been like, I was like 16, but no, I didn't have a car.
So obviously you had to revisit the idea of doing a book on the Iron Sheik, because you talk about in the book how you had this idea when you were younger of 100% going to do the biography. The death threats from the Iron Sheik happen in front, not even online death threats. People get those all the time. These were in your face.
Yeah.
Death threats.
Right. No mistaking it. Like multiple choice. How do you want to die? he got really angry when I just fact checked him about a very trivial thing. And yeah. You know, he was just really volatile at that point, you know, deep into the addiction. And so little things could set him off. I mean, there were moments of clarity. And I think that's why I always knew and deep down that this wasn't really him, that, you know, the real Khosrow Vaziri, his real identity, is a very, very different person. And ultimately, I'm glad that person came back at the end, and, you know, that he was able to kind of come full circle in his life.
Was it hard for you to find a new starting point? Like before, obviously, the goal was to do the biography on Sheik. But instead, like, was it hard for you to kind of find it? Or did you think like, well, I'll do something similar to the Wax Pack and just kind of bring it in?
I think the Wax Pack provided some of the template for how to do a book about a road trip to find my childhood heroes. But this was different. The Wax Pack had a little more randomness because, like, other than these 15 players being in the same pack of cards, they don't necessarily have anything in common. So I figured, well, if I write about the guys that were on the show when Iron Sheik became the champion, I have some kind of, you know, cohesion between them. And I can also tell the story of how Vince McMahon Jr. built the company from this regional territory to this national behemoth. And, you know, the Iron Sheik story is intertwined with that, and Hulk Hogan and all of that. So it was also, there was some structure around as a secondary story telling the expansion of the WWF story.
And when it comes to, like, you know, meeting these wrestlers, like, especially, you know, all these years later after the height of their fame and all this other stuff, you know, what was it kind of like seeing how they sort of blended, you know, who they actually are with somehow, like, with the retelling of stories and stuff, and seeing, like, you know, Tony Atlas bringing out Tony Atlas, or like Sheik bringing out Sheik, you know, like, how did you see sort of them kind of, you know, telling the story straight, like, from their actual, you know, shoot perspective versus sort of trying to keep kayfabe alive a little bit?
Yeah, and I think, you know, all these guys, no matter how much, like, they never quite fully blend in. Like, there's something about, I don't know if it's because we saw them on TV so much, but when you see a former wrestler in person, there's just a certain presence they have, even years later, that just kind of catches you. They, you know, they stand out. They're something about their aura or something. So I think even the guys that are more well adjusted in the latter part of their life, there's so much of that performer still in them that it is hard for them to completely detach from that. I mean, Tito Santana, when I met him at his house in New Jersey, I did all this research on his upbringing in Texas, and up through into his mid-20s, he went by his real name, which was Merced Solis.
Yeah.
And so everyone in Texas call, you know, his family, they all call him Merced. You know, then he becomes Tito Santana, with totally fictional name. And I have no idea. It's kind of awkward. Like, I didn't know when I went up to shake his hand, like, what do I call him? I don't know what he even goes by. And then to find out that his wife, Leah, who he's been with for, you know, 40 years or so, 40 some years, she calls him Tito because when they met, he was already a wrestler. They met at a bar. He introduced himself as Tito. So it's like, I mean, that's kind of weird to me that, like, even your wife would call you your stage name, but that's the level at which this character, you know, penetrated their identity.
And I think you're right. Like, nobody, wrestler's job is to go to a massive room and work the room, whatever way they're working, right? If they're working heel, they're trying to get heat. If they're working babyface, they're trying to get the crowd behind them. So you're right that like there's no way for them to not stand out. They're used to walking into a room and immediately trying to elicit some sort of reaction,
right,
without knowing people personally. So I can see that making it really hard for them to.
Well, I think probably like when a writer comes to them, and I think a lot of journalists, a lot of writers who would interview these wrestlers, they want to ask them more about the angles and the storylines. Yeah. So they're more accustomed to that. But I'm coming at them and asking more personal stuff a lot of the time, or about their family life. And so I think sometimes that can kind of catch them off guard, or they may not be used to answering those things. And maybe it is hard for them to answer those things as their real identity, right? As their, yeah, you know, versus what Tony, what would Anthony White say here versus Tony? I mean, and even in that chapter, at one point he says like, Anthony White is gone.
Yeah.
Or he said something like, when he was, you know, we go to the nursing, the assisted living where his wife was, and everyone, he's cracking jokes and, you know, he's making, you know, little one-liners, and people are recognizing him as Tony Atlas. And he said something afterwards in a very reflective moment where he was like, you know, these people want to see Tony Atlas. They don't want to see Anthony White.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we went to the restaurant for lunch, I mean, again, this wasn't planned. We walk into a restaurant with the town that he lives, and this person is requesting a selfie, and then this person is paying for his lunch. And this is, you know, this is just a Tuesday or something, right? So, it's got to mess with your head a little bit, like,
yeah,
to know that these people, they're not really like they're in love with a fantasy version of you, but that's not really you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's, it's kinda weird how that works out, because like you don't really see that in any other form of like sport or entertainment. Like, I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio is like as bigger than life as it gets probably as an actor, but no one goes up to him and is like, hey, Jordan Belfort, what's up?
Right.
Like, you know? Well, you definitely know that some complete douchebag frat bro has absolutely done that. You're Jordan Belfort.
Yeah, but like it's just weird how that works in wrestling. Like, you don't see that, even, you know, relatively similar things like MMA. Like, you know, Conor McGregor isn't going out there. Well, maybe that's probably not the best example, because I feel like Conor's crossover is probably the exact same. But, you know, there are people who like go up in the performative way to sort of sell themselves to audiences. And then, you know, probably behind the scenes are just like a normal person who's just like, yeah, I'm not actually like. Like Sean O'Malley is not like, yeah, you can call me Sugar. Like, he's probably just like, no, my name's Sean.
Right. Well, I think someone like John Cena might have it easier because he's John Cena. I mean, that's his real name, right? He's not, and his character was not, I mean, it was like an exaggerated version, but it's not like he's this total gimmick.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas Iron Sheik, as you detail in the book, like very different than the man that is actually playing Iron Sheik, like two very different folks, that's going to be really difficult for him to turn on and off.
Right. And with him, it's especially complicated because here he, in real life, Khosrow Vaziri is one of the most patriotic wrestlers of all time. I mean, he coached the U.S. Olympic wrestling team. He, you know, he defected. He left Iran. He wanted out. You know, he was afraid of his circumstances when one of his friends mysteriously died, you know, who was like a folk hero in Iran. And he got on a plane without speaking any English in 1969 and came to the US and really, other than one brief visit, never went back to Iran. And it's interesting too, like I was able to talk to a journalist in Iran. And again, it's you know, sometimes I think in the US we take for granted certain liberties, but like, it's crazy that here in 2024, like a writer in Iran is like, wouldn't let me identify him because he's like, you know, the press is not free over there.
I mean,
it's a complete censored society. And he was like, you have to understand, like in 1984, at the height of the Iron Sheik's popularity, no one in Iran even knew who he was.
Yeah.
Like they didn't even know, like there was no access to, you know, Western TV or culture. There's no internet. So it's just kind of funny that in, you know, on TV, here you had the Iron Sheik saying, he's going to take the belt back to Iran, to the Ayatollah. Meanwhile, people in Iran, and if anyone did know about him, they thought it was a disgrace. You know, they didn't like him because, like, you're making a mockery of our culture.
Yeah. And one of the things I want to talk about, because we've kind of been around it a little bit so far as we've been talking, is you mentioned the boys have a tendency to stretch the truth, we'll say.
Yeah.
Through, you know, Hulk Hogan saying how many people were in attendance at WrestleMania 3, and then Andre weighed 700 pounds. Tony Atlas saying that the ledge he fell off was 10 feet off the ground when it is very not. Does that make your job harder trying to write the book?
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's the hardest part of all was, I mean, that's really one of the goals of the book is to write a shoot about a work, right? and in a culture that has like almost no written history.
Yeah.
It relies on a lot of retelling of stories. I'm sure I didn't get everything 100% right, but I tried really hard by consulting a lot of sources and talking to multiple people and fact-checking in real time if somebody said something that didn't seem accurate. It's a lot harder to like do background research. Like for a baseball book, well, there's every single newspaper in America had a sports section that covered baseball, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's only so many articles that Dave Meltzer is going to put out there
that right,
really so, like, align so, with what I mean, you're looking for.
You know, Meltzer is interesting because I understand like some people's criticisms of Meltzer, but at the same time, like if it wasn't for The Observer, you know, whatever you think of Meltzer, there's a ton of information in those early years that was put on paper that says like, okay, this event happened in this town and this is the attendance. And, you know, like that is like the best thing we have to like a historical record, really.
Yeah, because otherwise it's just going to be Hulk Hogan saying there were a million people in attendance. Like it's just going to keep getting ballooned higher and higher. It's just it's good to have something written down.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you circling back to your interactions with Sheik, when you're there talking to him and he, you know, compares himself to Sylvester Stallone as far as star power goes.
Within 5 seconds of meeting him, yeah.
Yeah. Does that sort of just like immediately justify all the emotional capital that you invested in him from an early age? Just like, oh, this guy really, okay, he's awesome.
Well, actually, I would say the opposite. Like, maybe that seems weird, but it was more like the first sign. Because I think, you know, that was probably the first time I had really met a wrestler, a famous wrestler, like outside the context of the show.
Yeah.
And it was like almost, I think, a wake-up call that like, oh, no, these guys are kind of delusional. You know, it's cool that like, you know, to meet the Iron Sheik, but... It was the first sense that I think a lot of wrestlers that, you know, they're stuck in their own celebrity sometimes because they don't know how to let go of that character.
Yeah.
And so that was probably my reaction to that.
And would you say that was kind of like your, I mean, every wrestling fan has that at a certain point in their life is sort of like the bubble bursting moment where, you know, these figures who you hold in such high regards because they're entertaining you.
Certainly driving him to buy crack was definitely a bubble bursting moment.
I didn't know where that was going to go in the, because I think that was in the prologue and I'm reading through and I'm like, is the Iron Sheik getting crack?
Yeah.
I didn't think that's where
I think like, you know, my editors were very wary of me being overly descriptive, let's say,
fair,
in those sections, but you can read between the lines and I was driving him and he was getting, you know, hard drugs, like,
yeah,
I mean, I wasn't like walking up to the door with him and like, you know,
and I'm Brad. Yeah.
I was like keeping the Honda Accord warm and, you know, but yeah, no, I mean, that was, and I did write about that in the prologue that like, I really felt, and I still do feel bad about that. Like, it doesn't matter how much of a fan you are, it's messed up to like help someone, in, you know, they're not helping themselves if you're enabling their addiction, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't think it was fair for him to put me in that position of asking me for money all the time, but no. I was a grown adult, you know, I did that.
It's still, but it's, it does, it plays on the fandom, right? Of like, hey, this guy really likes me. I bet I can.
Well, and then you realize, like, Tony Atlas talks about this, like, and these guys, they lived the life because there were so many fans willing to do whatever. I mean, drive them around, get them women, get them drugs, get, you know, discounted hotels, rent-free cars. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes we forget. I mean, I forget, right? I'm writing these books about guys that in their prime were in their 20s and early 30s. Like, I mean, no offense to you, I don't know how old you guys are, but you know, you're kind of an idiot when you're in your 20s versus when you're in your 60s, right? Like,
Somebody who's out of his 20s now, I agree. 100%.
Like, I mean, I was an idiot. I mean, like, you know, you're young, but, you know, none of us had the level of fame. So imagine, like, how you are in your 20s, but then add in all this fame and adulation. Like, it's no wonder that almost nobody keeps a level head.
Yeah. And, like, just that level of access to just whatever you want at any time.
And I think, like, where WWE has, where the culture's gotten better and healthier, is, and there's still plenty of reform that needs to happen in wrestling and WWE, but the fact that their schedule is not as crazy, the fact that it's now, like, a, you know, it's a Wall Street publicly traded company.
Yeah.
There's more corporate responsibility. I mean, there was no HR department in the WWF in 1984. Like, they just literally didn't exist.
Yeah.
Right. And so you can imagine in this environment what kinds of things went on. And I got into that a little bit with, like, the Middle East tours and the plane ride. And
oh, yeah.
And that's only the tip of the iceberg from that era.
Want to talk about the plane ride later. Definitely. And that actually brings up a good point, the good question I had, which is, what are your thoughts on how the wrestling industry has changed since the time you were a fan through the 2000s, everything to now, the last few years, you know, Vince stepping away, AEW's emergence, the way that wrestling is kind of conducted now. How do you, like, what do you think about the changes to the industry, and what changes do you still kind of want to see in the wrestling industry from a fan perspective?
Well, wrestling is now firmly a TV commodity, right? Yeah. I think that's different than what it was for the first 80 years of its existence. Now it's an entertainment commodity that is everything through TV and internet, you know. So it's, you know, going from a model of where, like, the live events were the basis, things are very different now. And so there's got to be different emphasis placed on production and distribution and all these things. In terms of, I was talking to Dave Meltzer on his show, and, you know, he was asking me something similar, and I was saying that I don't relate as much to the in-ring product as I did as a kid, because to me it's lost a little bit of the psychology, because if a guy hits his finisher like six times, it's like, what's, you know, okay, the seventh one works, like, who cares? Like, I felt like WrestleMania, the matches are great. I mean, it's so much more impressive, the athleticism, but I'm trying to think, like, any of those marquee matches, you know, if you're kicking out over and over and over again at 2 3/4, it just takes the impact of the moves and lowers it. And Dave had a good point, which he was like, well, yeah, but to some extent, all of us will always over romanticize the thing we liked when we were kids. And that's true. Like, I grew up on the 80s product, so I'm comparing it to that. And I don't even know if it's possible at 43 to love wrestling as much as I did when I was a kid, because there was something about the product that was kids driven.
Yeah. And, like, I started watching it when it was not kids driven, Attitude Era, and Javier was Ruthless Aggression. Like, we're all going to love our era. Like, whatever era was our era is going to be the one we default to.
So, like, what do you guys think about that thing I was talking about with, like, all the false finishes? Does that bother you?
To an extent, yes. I think it's just become, like, part of the deal. Like, I think I now would just expect it. It does change when I see something end after one finisher. I'm like, oh, okay, like, that's the surprise now. It's not that the finish happened, but that it didn't take four. It took one. So I like when they are able to kind of subvert that way, but I think I just take it as part of the deal now. I don't know about you, Javi.
I think for me a lot, it's not as, like, impactful for me, because I, pretty early on, like, I was only, like, 12, 13 years old watching, like, Ring of Honor in the mid-late 2000s, early 2010s, and like New Japan and all that stuff. So like you see that style of wrestling where it is a lot of like hitting your finisher, you know, so you have to somehow make your moves even bigger as you go, especially if it's like a series of matches where this is like you're now in like the third match you've had with this person over the last stretch of months. Like one finisher's not going to get it done. And I am still, I guess this is just kind of a personal thing. I'm one of those people that like, even though I know I'm an internet wrestling fan, right? Like clearly we have this podcast. Like I'm in the know as far as like, I know this one finisher isn't going to end the match, but when the person kicks out at 2¾, I'm still going to have a reaction.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I guess what popped in my head was it's much more like video game-ish to me now.
That's
like, again, I don't play video game, but I see them and like, and you play a video game, you're killing lots of people. You're getting hit, you know, it's like constant stimulation. So I could see where if you didn't grow up like I did with that era that I had, it's like there's still suspension of disbelief and there's still suspense because it's like, okay, when is the finish going to happen? Right. Yeah. That becomes the point of anticipation. Like, ooh, he just did that. Okay, even if he did it 7 times, like, will it be the 8th or the 9th? Or the, you know, it's, and I can get that because I watched the match and I'm still into it. I'm like, okay, what's going to be the finish? And because they're so into subverting expectation, there's always like that challenge of what crazy thing is going to happen next. Yeah.
Or like say one Seth, good thing Seth versus Drew, this from WrestleMania, like starting with the Claymore, like Drew hits the Claymore to start the match. And I'm like, ah, that's different. There you go.
No, that's good. So, okay, but here's some little things. I appreciate that you guys are different ages and eras, so you can tell me what you think about this. But one thing I was thinking watching WrestleMania was if they made the counting by the referee, not the pinfall, but counting outside the ring more like it used to be, which it was always a little bit fishy, whatever, but. Yeah. Now, like, guys will go out there for like 4 minutes and it's like, it's just a joke that the referee is counting.
Yeah.
But think about if you actually enforced it more, like that could create suspense.
Yeah. And that's something that New Japan does really well is they are legit with their 20 counts. And so it's something we've noted on the podcast covering different eras and different brands of wrestling is that like, why aren't people counting? It's a very simple concept.
It is such a notorious, I went to an AEW show when they came through to Boston a while back, and it infuriated me every time they went to the outside and the referee was just standing there and they at no point, not even like they started the count late. They just never did a count. Like the wrestlers got back into the ring and it was fine.
At WrestleMania, like when they would go into the corner up on the ropes, they're not counting. Some of them referees are not counting anymore.
Yeah.
Like so those, you know, like the rules are kind of ignored, right?
The thing that give it a little bit of the more legitimacy. This is a competition. It must fall within these parameters is kind of being left to the side. And that's something we like going back and watching all these different wrestlers through their matches is like this week we're covering the Wild Samoans. Very different type of wrestling than anything happening right now. Like seeing Afa and Sika in the 80s, like it was very different than any sort of tag match right now, but you have to appreciate it for what it was. So you can see a lot of modern fans who go back and look at it and go like, this is boring and nothing happens. It's only 8 minutes long and they hit 2 chops. Like, no, it's different. It's meant to be that way.
Notoriously did not use tag ropes either, those two guys.
No, they did not believe in tag ropes. But
well, they still, I mean, guys still do use tag ropes now, right?
That's true.
It depends. Yeah. Depends on who's out there.
Yeah. While we're talking about modern wrestling, what is your favorite match of the last 10 years?
Ooh, 10 years. Now you're exposing my lack of watching it consistently. I mean, I don't know. I will say that I can't pick a match in the last 10 years, but I can tell you who I like in terms of the current guys is I like Austin Theory. Which
Okay,
most people are like, what? Like that is like, it's kind of like the, maybe it's saying you like the Iron Sheik in 1985, right? Like, like not a popular take.
What about him?
He's a good wrestler. He's a real good wrestler.
I just think he's, I think he has like the it factor.
That's fair.
That, you know, whether he'll become a big star, I don't know. But when I just saw his, like, something about his presentation, I was like, oh, this guy's like, he really makes you want to hate him. Like, and not like, but not like true. Cheer him, you know? And I actually really like Gunther.
Yes.
Because yeah. he's again, like, I like that he's a true heel.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, talk so about a throwback.
Right. So many of the heels now are popular.
Yeah.
Right. Like, even like his Triple H is, was he ever a heel or a face? Like,
oh, Triple H was 100% a heel. 100% a heel. Okay,
but I feel like even when he was a heel, he would get cheered by like 40%.
It was only when he had his reign of terror
It's not my me, I can tell you that.
Yeah, when he had his reign of terror with the World Heavyweight title for a number of years and like going over Booker T at WrestleMania and things like that, like that's when he was in true heel mode because it was also his status of being the husband of Stephanie definitely gave him different heel heat that is unattainable for other people.
Okay, what about like 2016 on Triple H?
No, because we knew he was playing a role and he still would do cool stuff. So I think
he also just wasn't around much.
Yeah, yeah. It all depends. But I do like we talk about like the throwback heels, people who were genuinely like, no, you're not supposed to like me at all.
Like you don't see little kids or anyone with a Gunther t-shirt.
No, you just
I don't know if there is a Gunther t-shirt.
That's true. I can't
never seen any Imperium t-shirts out there.
I will say, like, from the crowd at WrestleMania, like, certain matches were 50-50. Like, 100% heels and babyfaces were both getting chance. Certain matches, though, everyone was against the heel. Gunther, people were very much against Gunther.
I also think it's interesting that Imperium, it's like, now because the way the world has changed, you know, like, one guy's from Germany or a bunch from Austria, right? But, like, they're not going to vilify someone for being, like, a German. So now they're just this, like, amorphous, ambiguous fascists. right, they're like European fascists, and they like come out, and all their mannerisms are very like Nazi-ish.
Yeah,
but they're not going to outright say that because
it's the elitism. That's what it is. People don't like them because they're elitist. They're all prim and proper.
That's true, but it may be more like older fans feeling this way. But there's definitely hints of that, like fascism. Yeah. You know,
yeah, like if this was like some years ago, they would just be like, "You're all German."
Right.
Like you're Italian, you're Austrian, you're German. You're all German.
Right.
And you're all going to have a German gimmick.
Exactly, right.
So and you're now
a
commander.
Interesting that they're still playing to some extent that, in a subtle way, that foreign heel idea. Yeah. But it's 2024 style, right?
Yeah.
And when sort of looking at the business in sort of through the modern lens, you know, there's the last 40 years of wrestling have really been synonymous with one guy, and that's Vince McMahon Jr.
Sure.
And when you know you write, when writing the book, there's a lot of it does come in sort of the overlap period because there were guys who were under Vince Sr. and guys who were under Vince Jr. and guys who were around for both. When like going through everything, collecting all the information that you could, having all these interviews, What were some differences that you sort of noticed between the two Vince's father and son?
Right. I mean, I would love to be able to interview, obviously you can't, like Vincent J, Vincent Sr. and Vincent K, Vincent Jr. about their relationship because they seem like such vastly different people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The biggest thing is pretty much everyone I spoke to said that Vince McMahon Sr. was a man of his word. And that Vincent McMahon Jr. was not. Like, plain and simple. Like, that's the biggest difference. And clearly Vince Jr. idolized his father, but clearly he was also traumatized by having been ignored by his dad till he was like 15. So, and I don't, you know, and so while Vince Sr. generally comes across well in people's descriptions, the ultimate heel move is to like ignore that you have a son for 15 years.
It's true. Yeah.
So like that would take some explaining, right? From Vince Sr.'s part. There was an article I dug up that I included in the book where Vince Jr. talks about how much affection he has, looks up to his grandfather, who was also a promoter in wrestling, Jess McMahon.
Yeah.
And his father. But he wanted to make them proud, but Vince McMahon Jr. grew up the first 15 years of his life in the South, moving around, getting beat on by an abusive stepfather and apparently sexually molested by his own mom. What Vince has done in his life is pretty reprehensible, but that being said, like, he clearly had a reprehensible upbringing too.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's something that's hard to kind of, there may be no more enigmatic person I've seen in terms of their existence in the public eye than Vince McMahon Jr. You feel like you know things about him, but you don't.
Right.
But then you hear the backstory and like, that makes sense, but it's not a reason.
He's an example of just like people, you know, it's a cliche, but people are complicated. Like people are capable. The same person is capable of doing something very wonderful and generous and then something heinous.
Yeah.
Right. And it seems hard to reconcile that, but it's true all the time in life that people have multiple sides. And, you know, there are stories about Vince McMahon being very generous and very kind. Right. And then there's the opposite. And they're both probably true. But I think it just goes to show you how, and this is, again, no, not breaking any new ground here to say that, like, childhood explains so much. Yeah. And so much of when people get into positions of power and influence, when they make mistakes or act a certain way, it often, I think, is because of not getting what they needed when they were kids.
Yeah. I went to school to be a teacher, and they told us in university, they said, like, you can learn everything you want here. You're going to taught the way you were taught. Like, yeah. However you were taught as a kid, like, whatever teachers that put an imprint on you, you're going to teach like them. And I was like, well, then what am I spending all this money for? But it was true. Like, essentially, like, you're going to take everything, and it's your upbringing is going to be a big part of how you act once you get that power. And then Vince got an unfathomable amount of power over a lot of interesting and beautiful and magical people, and he was allowed to do whatever he wanted with them. It did become a really running theme in the book. You're running through, and it's like, and Vince said this. Vince would do the opposite of this. Right. Vince would not follow up his word. I was like, it became a fun game reading the book. I'm like, and there's Vince not.
And keep
doing
in mind, Vince
yet.
Is only writing about guys in the beginning of this story, right?
Yeah.
I mean, basically, this, you know, we're ending in the early 90s, pretty much, in terms of the stories that I was telling. So. And that's before Vince got anywhere close to the power that he got later.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was before they went public, before he had to take on the government, before all this stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I guess on a to sort of switch to a more lighthearted note here, you have mentioned, obviously, that, you know, you deem wrestling from your childhood to be sort of a superior product to what we see today.
Well,
not that it's worse.
Yeah, right. For me, it's more enjoyable. It's back for, then.
Yes,
for you.
Yeah. So I, as someone who is 26 years old and has zero comprehension over what it was like at the time, and in my rewatching of it all, have still not been able to understand it. Could you explain Demolition to me?
Demolition. Okay.
I don't understand why Demolition was ever popular.
Okay,
I just don't.
I'm trying to think of an analogy of the current guys that would.
You could anything. Go anywhere you want with this. Music, movies, whatever you want to compare them to. Go right ahead. I will never be able to understand
and
it.
And we did a deep dive episode on Demolition, and still Javier came up being like, I don't get it.
I think
Demolition, it was simply the look,
mm-hmm.
and it was the clubbing style. Like when they would do that, like just like the hit, like the axe handle over and over and over on the guy and just boom, 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 like they would pummel the guy, right? That was like, you just, no one else did that. And so I know it may not look impressive now, but at the time, like that style of just like, just beating on somebody over and over again, and the leather studs with the face paint, and the Rick Derringer entrance music.
Mm-hmm.
It you know, the tag. You got to think about the tag teams in that era were like the British Bulldogs, the Killer Bees, the Rougeau Brothers, the Islanders, the Hart Foundation. I mean,
Strikeforce.
They were these like very like athletic, like good worker kind of clean cut, you know, guys that, you know, that had a certain presentation, and Demolition was like just the complete opposite of all of that. So, and they were heels that came in and just beat down your pretty boy baby faces. Right. So that's the best I can do to like explain why. I mean, they were an example of a team that, like, so them and Jake the Snake Roberts and Rowdy Roddy Piper were heels that became so cool. It was like the Stone Cold thing.
Yeah.
The fans turned them into baby faces.
I just will always think it's like someone becoming a baseball fan in New York and choosing the Mets. Like, the Road Warriors were right there.
Well, okay. You know? Another thing I was going to say was the Road Warriors, right? That's the other, but the Road Warriors, like that, you could ask the same question about why the Road Warriors were popular.
Well, they were just huge. Like, it's the size difference is more noticeable with the World Warriors because they were legitimately just so big.
And I also think in WWF, everybody was a larger than life athlete. So the difference between Demolition and who they were going up against was probably a little less stark than the Road Warriors versus who they were going up against.
So, Javi, is it more like you're just not impressed with Bill Eadie and Barry Darso's physique?
Yeah, it's not just that. Yes, I'm definitely body shaming them, but at the same time, I don't know. I just don't like the wrestling. Isn't like it? Just it never really clicked with me. I was hoping you would be able to sway me a little bit here, but honestly, I've just left this thinking more so that I would just watch the Road Warriors,
right?
And. Right. I will say Bill Eadie seems like a lovely man.
Yes, he seems like a great human being. It's a shame what happened that he wasn't able to watch The Hunt for Red October that day, because I think that is a fantastic movie.
I think my original last line in that chapter was like, Bill still has not seen The Hunt for Red October. it came like the end of that chapter is very like serious, and I was like, that's not going to work.
What a beautiful movie that is.
It's a great movie. The other one we want to talk to you about is a person who you didn't really get the chance to talk to during the book, but you did hang out in Tampa, is Hulk Hogan, who, again, it plays a big role in this because he is who takes the title off of the Iron Sheik after he wins it in 83. And now, what was Hulkamania like? Because you obviously were cheering for the Iron Sheik, so you were on the opposite side. You do say that you were still swept up in Hulkamania at the same time.
I was. And I was too young to watch Hogan and Sheik in their match. I mean, I always liked Sheik more, so I grew up and Iron Sheik was like, had his, he got fired like when I was only six. So
yeah,
he was gone a lot. And then, you know, it was all Hogan. So I was a big Hulkamaniac. And I don't know, again, like, is there anyone now, I know this, even as popular as Cody Rhodes is, for example.
Oh, no, I don't think there's anyone that comes even relatively close to Hogan, even on the decline, like in the 90s. Like, still think even then, Hogan was probably still more popular than anyone nowadays.
I mean, part of it is that you didn't have like the contrarian smart fans that will always boo, like, there's always going to be a contingent that's not going to boo, not going to cheer for the ultimate babyface, right? You didn't really have, maybe a little bit, like people that cheered Paul Orndorff over Hulk Hogan. You know, you had little bits of that here and there. But
maybe like your Savage fans were probably out there doing that. But
yeah, you had some Savage. I mean, there were even some Andre the Giant fans I know back in the day. But I think Hogan, like, because it was so firmly... well, here's an example. Like I'm in Rhode Island now. I drove from California a month ago to come here. And on my way over like 9 or 10 different states, I stopped and just asked strangers on the street. I said, I'm doing a survey. Can you name a single professional wrestler, past or present? And I surveyed 90 people, half women, half men. I made sure to get different ethnicities and ages. And the number one answer was Hulk Hogan. The number two answer was either The Rock or John Cena.
Okay.
And of those 90 people, only two named a current wrestler, and that was Roman Reigns.
Oh, okay.
Not a single Cody Rhodes. So, like, and this is like in the build up to WrestleMania. So, and this is a question I have for everybody, like, as popular as wrestling is now, what does that say about the state of it versus what it was in the past?
I think longevity is sort of a thing that really has helped, especially Hulk Hogan's legacy, The Rock's legacy. I mean, we're 25 years now of The Rock. We're 25 plus years of Austin. We're 40 plus years of Hogan at this point. Yeah. we really, as far as like the national consciousness goes, we're really, what, 3 years into the Cody Rhodes thing?
Right.
And for as big and popular as Cody is, you know, amongst wrestling fans who watch the product nowadays, there still hasn't been enough time, or really, in my opinion, that like specific moment that has sort of been able to get break him through to the national consciousness. I do think, I mean, Cody Rhodes, I'm not on TikTok, so I can't really explain, like, right, give you more sorts of that. But I have friends who are not wrestling fans in any capacity who like reached out to me over WrestleMania weekend and say, like, who's this Cody Rhodes guy? He's awesome. Like, right, you know, I think that Cody could get there eventually. And if there's anyone that's going to get there from like the current crop outside of Roman Reigns, I think it is Cody. But again, I just think it's the longevity thing. Like, right, with Cody.
Longevity definitely matters. But I still think that, like, if you did this experiment with the NBA, you would get LeBron James a lot.
Yeah.
Right.
And of course, you've had 20 years.
He's been around a lot. Okay. That's true. But I don't think you would get like
just like Bill Russell,
Michael Jordan more often than LeBron James.
Yeah.
Or I don't think you would get. So I guess my point is, like, there's something that shifted where Hulk, to answer your question, Hulk Hogan was a household name in 1986 at his peak. Right. Yeah. Like, so if we did this survey, if we did this experiment in 1986, I don't think you'd have all these people saying Bruno Sammartino. I think they would be saying Hulk Hogan. Even back then, even when he was just early in his popularity. And I think that, like, wrestling, like a lot of things, it doesn't occupy quite the same amount of space in the public consciousness that it did back in the 80s, because there's just so much more competing with it.
Yeah. Yes, there's definitely an oversaturation of entertainment.
That's true. Okay. I haven't had time with my own thoughts in years. I have just been looking at either big screen or little screen at all times. I want to talk about when you're doing the book and you're doing the road trip, some of the most surprising things you learned, things you didn't think you would find out, just something that really surprised you.
All right, so here's one that I was thinking about today that I keep forgetting to bring this up in interviews. So I think you guys are the first people I'll tell this to.
Oh, amazing. I got a scoop.
So I met with Brad Rygans. I don't know if you guys might not know who that is. Brad Rygans. He was in the AWA. He was briefly in the WWF. He was a really good amateur. He actually trained Brock Lesnar.
Okay.
So that might ring a bell. Yeah. So he was always like really good as a trainer, never had the charisma to make it big. Good friends with Hulk Hogan back when in the early years of Hogan in the AWA. And he told me that like around 86, 87, when he came into the WWF, that Vince brought him in because they were going to have a Hulk Hogan like training camp, like a wrestling school. And like Hulk was like, it was going to be like a Hulk would be like the head guy training people. And that Brad was brought in because he knew Hulk really well to like kind of figure out all the details and get this thing going. Huh. And this is like right at the height of Hulkamania, yeah, WrestleMania.
Okay.
And it never happened because at some point Vince McMahon, he was like, Hulk's too big. Like he just doesn't have we can't take him off the road to do this.
Yeah.
So I asked Brad if he had any of the documents from that, and he didn't have them handy, but I would love to see like what the plan was for a Hulk Hogan school back in the late 80s.
Yeah, we're getting like Hulk Hogan NXT. That sounds great.
All right, guys, here's the promo. Just drink as much Red Bull as you can and start screaming about getting little kids to believe in you.
Hey, that's the Ultimate Warrior program. So, all right.
in the book, I put in part of the promo that he cut before the Iron Sheik match.
Yeah.
And I wanted the whole thing. And again, like this is something I learned, you could call it a surprise, that this is what you guys were asking about. But when you write a book, like it was shocking to me how scared publishers are about getting sued.
Yeah.
So like they wouldn't even let me put the whole promo in because they're like, it violates some copyright law to have like more than three lines of dialogue or something. And I was like, really? Like, someone's going to sue me because I put like a 1 minute promo in.
Well, Hogan might. Of anyone in the industry that would do it, it would be him.
But I wish that the whole promo had been in there, because it like just batshit crazy, right? It's those promos from the 80s, like just nonsense that they're, I mean, not even Ultimate War, forget the Warrior stuff, like just regular promos.
Just, yeah, what you gonna do, brother, when I'm coming to town and I'm gonna knock you out and then I'm gonna take the title?
It's just spiking vitamin sales everywhere. So reading the book, there were a couple things that stood out to me in terms of big surprises. One, there is the story that everyone knows, every wrestling fan. It's like the third fact everyone thinks about with WrestleMania. Howard Finkel named WrestleMania.
Right.
And then reading this book and my world shatters. And it was Rex Jones.
Rex Jones. I'm still trying to find Rex Jones, track him down.
Yeah, that blew my mind. It's just it, and it's something that you do really well in this book, is there's like the main story and then there's these little asides. Here's a little thing, a little fun fact. It's a really accessible book, even if you're not a wrestling fan.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
like you do a really good job explaining a lot of the things. But then there's these little things for wrestling fans too. We're like, oh, by the way, it's not Fink who named WrestleMania. I'm like, I'm sorry. Right. What?
When I tried to, like, you know, again, I was cognizant the whole time of like wanting to be accessible to a general reader, but also giving little Easter eggs to wrestling fans. Like, even like a couple of times, I don't know if you noticed this, but like I would use language like, you know, and this started the New World Order of, there's a few of those where it's like an inside joke kind of, if you know wrestling really well, you'll get why I chose those words, you know?
Yeah. A little nod to those in the know.
Yeah. Right. The other one is a story I had never heard of. What was it like hearing about that plane ride?
Yeah, the original plane ride from hell.
Yes.
Well, that was surreal because I didn't know any of that was going to come out of my conversations. But talking to Mike Breen, who was on that flight, who was a referee, and talking to Jim Troy, who was the head of that tour, and hearing about Jimmy's Superfly Snuka just being absolutely insane on a commercial flight. And, you know, attacking Tim White, the referee, and attacking Mike Breen, the referee. And there were other things that where Snuka got detained for cocaine possession. And I mean, I have some more of those. I couldn't put everything in the book. So I have this, I'm building this website that's up now called thebradpack.com. And I'm putting like the raw audio from some of these interviews on there. So if you want to hear the whole interview with Jim Troy about all the crazy Middle East stuff, like that'll be up there. And cause there's a lot more of that kind of thing, but yeah, I was just thinking like, what would it be like to be on that plane and have this crazed Fijian like lurching across the aisle? And the funniest part was that I talk about how, you know, Snuka throws Mike Breen through the bathroom door and then tries to gouge his eyes out. And then they all get up and the magnificent Morocco, who's like in storyline feuding with Snuka, you know, he jumps in to pull everyone off. But then the Tonga kid, who's like friends with Snuka, he starts jumping in.
Yeah.
And at some point, Mike Breen realizes he's like bashing the Tonga kid against the emergency door.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's probably not good for anybody.
Yeah.
No, probably a bad idea. I also like when it's like Snuka like calms down for a couple of hours and then he's like, round two.
He's been able to cool off, but the revenge hasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are so many just insane stories that came out of this book. Just insane. I mean, that's just the history of pro wrestling where it's just all insane stories. When it comes to getting these, just like somehow being able to milk these stories out of people, did you feel like when you were doing these interviews, it was sort of more like you had to like prod a little bit in order to get there? Or did you feel like the people that you were interviewing were sort of just willingly able to just get that right out?
No, I had to, you have to ask a certain way, or I mean, I think you have to be afraid to get rejected or to have things go sour. I mean, really, you have to, like, it's a little bit scary, right? But you have to take risks, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And like, if I asked I'm trying to remember an example. I'm asking Tito Santana about his relationship with his dad. You know, he may say, well, it wasn't great. And then I could just stop, or I could be like, well, can you elaborate on that? And then, you know, like, you know, just kind of asking for more elaboration, asking follow-ups, following a thread of conversation a certain way, even if it's going in a direction that I might not have planned on. So yeah, I think it has, like, I think a lot of it has to do with how you, what questions you also choose to ask, because in a limited amount of time, again, like with someone like Tito, I didn't even ask really about like his most legendary feuds. I started out asking about his El Matador run, mm-hmm. and the end of his run, right? Which is probably not what he gets asked very much.
Yeah. Nope.
But I wanted to know, like, well, what did it feel like to be 40 years old and like unemployed? You know, what do you do? Like, what is your next step? And so yeah, that's I guess the best way I could address that.
I thought it was interesting how it seems like a lot of wrestlers gravitate towards teaching people. I think they like having people listening to them.
Yeah.
I think they're used to being like, hey, I'm in charge here. Everyone listen to me. Let me cut this promo on how to do, you know, chemistry or whatever other things they're teaching.
But interestingly, a lot of them also before they were wrestlers were not, I'm trying to think if it was anyone, like no one was described as like kind of this like extroverted.
No, everyone seemed to be pretty shy.
Outgoing. Yeah. Like, I mean, maybe like a Tony Atlas was probably pretty outgoing as a kid growing up.
He doesn't exactly strike me as someone who's reserved at any point in his life.
And Hogan was described as like a performer because he was the musician, but like never.
Yeah, no one ever described Terry Bollea as like the guy that wants to like be seen in the room.
No,
you know. But I think music for him was the gateway to wrestling. I mean, like that. Like I think he likes the stage, but he flips a switch, and that was even true before he was Hulk Hogan. Like when he was on stage, he knew how to flip that switch and be a performer on, you know, in that setting.
Yeah. As we kind of wrap up here, I want to go back to the guy who's kind of like at the heart of the book, which is the Iron Sheik. Yeah. And on our podcast, we cover wrestlers through five of the most important matches. And this week we're going to cover the Iron Sheik because obviously we talked to you. We have this newfound appreciation for the Iron Sheik. If you had us watch at least one match, if there's one match you could recommend for us to watch of the Iron Sheik, what match would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. He was really good. It's hard to find matches from when he was really, really good.
Yeah.
Which is
a problem we run into all of the time on this podcast.
But
I usually do my best. There's usually some sort of like, probably not safe for my computer, like website that's Korean or Japanese or something that's got some stuff hidden in there.
That's true.
Well, so if you look at like in 1979, he wrestled Bob Backlund. That match is pretty slow though. I mean, it's a good technical match, but he had some good matches in 1980 against like Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair when he was in Mid-Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
1980-81. And then in terms of WWF, like his match against Tito Santana and Sergeant Slaughter in 84, those matches are pretty good. There's a good, like, not, it's not great, but like there's a good Hart Foundation versus Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff heel versus heel match from like 86 in the Boston Garden, which is kind of a weird, I was like, they did these weird matches sometimes, like the heels versus heels.
Yeah.
But really like, and they're actually, I've seen on YouTube, like there's like no sound, but there's a couple matches from when he was Khosrow Vaziri or Ali Vaziri in like 1973 or 75 when he's really young, and he's like doing drop kicks and he's doing, you know, leapfrogging, and he's doing you know, all these coming off the top rope. And so that's probably when he was the most, because you gotta remember by the time he won the belt he was already like 41.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine Sheik hitting a drop kick.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. That's going to be a little jarring if we get that one going.
I mean, like, he's got a full head of hair and he's 195 pounds and ripped and totally different look.
I felt so bad for his wife when all of a sudden it's like, and that's the thing we don't think about with wrestlers too. Like, they have people in their lives and they have to look like this 24/7. So like when, you know, Kane has to shave his head because he's getting unmasked, or Iron Sheik is going to shave his head and start doing the mustache. Like, this is how they're going to live for the rest of their life, and or at least for, and if this goes well, for a long time.
Well, and that's, I mean, this is where I feel like, you know, going to the conventions and seeing the guys that usually keep their look, it's like, that's where if I was the spouse, I'd be like, okay, once you retire, like, you don't need to look like this character anymore.
You know? Jim, but the mullet can go.
You're like this anymore.
Right. But back to where we started, that they don't want to let go of that character.
Yeah.
It's beyond me why they would keep the character is one thing. The look is another.
Yeah. The other thing is, you know, unfortunately, we did lose the Iron Sheik and we did lose Khosrow. And what do you miss most about him as someone who got to know him pretty well?
Well, I was really happy to see him at the end. You know, I ended up seeing him months before he passed away. I don't miss the pseudo Twitter rants or any of that stuff. I miss like the guy that I was happy to see again in 2022, who was just like this really humble, I mean, truly humble, not making Brian Blair humble, you know, just like I mean, this was Khosrow Vaziri. This was a humble, kind, generous, chivalrous guy that I only saw bits and pieces of when I knew him, when he was in better health. But seeing how happy his daughter, Nikki, and his wife, Carol, were to have that guy back, like, it's not about me. You know, I didn't know him. We weren't close like in the last many years, but I talked a lot to his daughter, Nikki, and I certainly could see, having seen the worst being around Carol, like, she was so, and I kind of put that in the end, she was so happy that like, oh, we're watching TV, sitting side by side together again. Like, that was like the best.
Yeah. It's what matters, right?
Yeah,
it's the part of these wrestling stories that gets forgotten about. It's the family, you know, them getting their right. their spouse, their father, their mothers, whatever it may be, getting them back and you know, at 100% back with the family and involved. That's really the best part of these stories that are like these sort of turnarounds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and quite the turnaround. It was a little heartbreaking to learn about the Twitter rants that it wasn't him, but I think we knew that.
We all knew. We just didn't want. We
didn't want to believe. It's like Santa Claus and wrestling.
Yeah. It's like wrestling. Yeah. We suspended our belief.
Right. I mean, that's it, right. Right to the end. It's like the book is about. Okay, this is the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. The Fink didn't name WrestleMania. Iron Sheik isn't calling people jabronis on Twitter. Like.
And he doesn't even hate Hulk Hogan.
He doesn't hate Hulk Hogan.
It's all been a lie.
It's all been a lie. Brad, we want to thank you for joining us and talking about the book. And it was such a great read. We encourage everybody to go and pick it up. The six pack on the open road in search of WrestleMania, available now. Brad, tell everybody where they can find you and stuff you have to plug.
Sure. Thanks, guys. It's been a lot of fun. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at BradPackBooks. And as I said earlier, I have a website, thebradpack.com, where I have all the bonus material from the book. So audio from interviews and all these documents that I found, like the WWF internal documents that show all kinds of stuff from the 80s that has not been put out there, like how much this pay-per-view made or how much what the attendance was at this show, that kind of thing. So if you're really into the wrestling history, that'll be fun to look at.
And there's a lot to dive into. I'm very excited for the plane ride audio. I cannot wait for that. Obviously, it's not from the plane ride, but just to hear the story from the mouth of someone who was there is going to be a lot to take in. I'm going to get my popcorn. I'm ready.
Yeah.
It's going to be make a whole night of it.
Yeah.
Again, thanks, Brad, for joining us. I'll do the outro stuff. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Crossbody of Work. If you want to catch the merch, it's in the bio in the YouTube video below, as well as in the show notes of the podcast. We'll be back to cover the Iron Sheik. That's who we're covering this week, because, you know, Brad has inspired us to go and dive into his favorite wrestler, the Iron Sheik. Thanks again for joining us, Brad, and we'll talk to everybody real soon.
All right, thanks a lot.